This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome to the first hour of USA Today. This is Pat. It is Thursday, February 8th. I will be bringing you the national and international news from USA Today. Top story, rebound is a record setter. In Florida, 1,000 manatees coming in from the cold warms the hearts of conservationists everywhere. Orange City, Florida. As the rising sun peeks through the trees along the Blue Spring run on cold winter mornings, park rangers peer down into the water, counting the Florida manatees basking in their version of a hot tub. On January 21st, a prolonged cold snap with temperatures in the 30s had plunged the waters of the adjacent St. John's River into the 50s. Fleeing the chilly river, herds of sea cows crowded into the warmer waters of the spring run. Given the cool, clear, glassy conditions and the hundreds of manatees crowded together and floating on top of one another, park rangers suspected a possible record count. They doubled up, having two rangers each count along the run, which meanders 4/10 of a mile from the spring, where the water bursts from an underground cavern to the river. Their final tally, 932, didn't just set a record. It rocketed past previous records, even the 736 they counted on New Year's Day. It's a far cry from the single-day record of 49 manatees celebrated 40 years ago and more than twice as many manatees as the single-day record set just 10 years ago. The new record is breathtaking and incredible for those who have watched over these animals for decades. Thrilling and nearly unbelievable, said John Bingston, a federal wildlife ecologist in Alaska. When Bingston completed his doctoral research on manatees in the St. John's River in 1981, only 35 of the bewhiskered marine mammals were seen in the spring run in a record-high single-day count. Those high numbers are heartening and a tribute to the conservation efforts and awareness of scientists, natural resource managers, and the public over the past several decades. The thriving manatee population in the St. John's is rooted in a range of protective efforts taken over decades, often through protracted legal battles and contentious public meetings. The numbers show the hard-fought measures are working, said David Hankla, a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service field office director and veteran of some of those bitter battles. That's what you'd expect for an animal not experiencing unnatural mortality, Hankla said. At a state scale, manatees have done extraordinarily well, he said. In the early 1990s, the population was estimated at about 1,500. Last fall, officials estimated the state's manatee population at 8,350 to 11,730, based on an assessment from 2021 to 2022. Manatees share Florida's waters with 1 million registered vessels and almost 22 million people. Though the St. John's manatees thrive under protected conditions, others face great peril. In the Indian River Lagoon on the state's east coast, more than 1,000 manatees died from 2020 to 2022, many of them starving from a lack of healthy seagrass after years of massive algae blooms. Poor water quality from a variety of factors is blamed. Manatees also see higher death rates on the state's southwest coast, where they contend with busy waters, red tide algal blooms, and other water quality problems. Federal officials downlisted manatees from endangered to threatened in 2017, but announced last October that they would review whether the manatees should be considered endangered again, given the increase in deaths in 2021 and 2022. When water temperatures drop below 68 degrees, the manatees are attracted to Blue Spring because its waters can be 20 degrees or more warmer than the river. Once they arrive, counting living animals stacked up on top of one another underwater isn't always an exact science, said Connor Wagner, Park Service specialist at Blue Spring. The park rangers start early, just after first light and before the park opens, counting from boardwalks and overlooks, while the manatees are undisturbed and still. Researchers with the Save the Manatee Club also count manatees in the spring run almost daily and work to identify individual animals. One of those researchers, Wayne Hartley, was a park specialist at Blue Spring before retiring. He has paddled a canoe among the sea cows for more than 40 years, identifying individuals based on unique propeller scars and other body characteristics. These days, he's amazed by the number of manatees he can't identify because they don't have any prop scars. On the day the park counted 932, Hartley and colleague Cora Burcham got into the water about an hour after the park rangers started, after the manatees had begun to move around and the wind picked up. Hartley said they counted nearly 700 manatees. Overall this season, Hartley and a colleague have identified more than 800 individual manatees, including more than 80 calves. The numbers are astonishing to Hartley and to many biologists, advocates, and elected officials who survived the battles that set the stage for this success story. Local resident Arnett Sherman visits the park a few days a week. "It's thrilling to see so many manatees at one time," Sherman said. Manatees have been protected in Florida since the late 1800s and were among 70 animals added to the nation's first endangered species list in 1967. But many credit acclaimed oceanographer Jacques Cousteau with riveting public attention on manatees. Cousteau visited Blue Spring, then a privately owned fish camp in 1971, filming the animals' scarred backs and people trying to ride them. Months after the episode aired on The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau in January 1972, the state bought the spring. By 1989, Florida had become a legal and political battleground as government agencies, prodded by the Save the Manatee Club and other nonprofits, worked to enact protections. The single-day high count at Blue Spring that year was 57 manatees. The state ordered key counties to write protection plans with boat speed limits to curtail collisions in areas frequented by manatees. The plan was particularly contentious in Volusia County, home of Blue Spring. Boaters and fishermen were concerned about economic consequences and argued they wouldn't be able to cover as much ground between fishing spots. At one point, an elected official exclaimed in angry frustration that the county should open a manatee canning factory. But the gruesome vessel-related deaths of two manatees in the St. John's in 1991 added fuel to the push to protect the animals. One of those, Sweet Gums, an animal featured in the Manatee Club's Adopt a Manatee program, suffered five deep gashes from a propeller, her spine severed in two places. Similar battles were waged for a decade over plans to restore the spring's water flow, which forced local utilities to find alternatives to meet the water needs of a rapidly growing population. And the state park angered swimmers when it closed the water to people during the winter to give the manatees space. In those contentious years, 800 or 900 manatees in the spring would have seemed outlandish, Hankla said. But together, the measures accomplished their purpose, creating a haven where the animals thrive. Today, Blue Springs State Park attracts about 700,000 visitors a year, more than half of them during the winter. And the wait to get into the park on the busiest days can take hours. On the river, boaters and anglers share the water with ecotours viewing the abundant wildlife. The manatee numbers show the protective measures are working, Hankla said. But if the water quality or quantity diminishes, it's a problem, he said. That's what we've seen happen in Indian River. Streaming deal could shake up TV sports. In a major move for streaming TV, three of the largest media companies are teaming up for a joint venture that will offer access to every major league sport and several others. Disney's ESPN, Fox Corporation Fox News, and Warner Brothers Discovery's TNT, TBS, and other networks will offer a comprehensive package this fall that includes NFL, NBA, MLB, and NHL games. You won't be able to watch every game, but it's an appealing bundle for cable cord cutters who are sports fans. Each company will own a third of the service, which does not yet have a name, pricing information, or a specific launch date, but is subject to finalizing agreements. But it's a further acknowledgement of the splintering of the cable bundle as more consumers gravitate to streaming. NFL games consistently top Nielsen ratings, and for several years, professional sports have led other live programming as a key to preserving the cable TV ecosystem, which has lost more than 25% of its subscriber base over the past several years. The new service will have its own dedicated management team, separate from its owners, the company said in a statement. Analyst Michael Nathanson of MoffettNathanson called the deal the streaming bundle we've been waiting for and said in a report Tuesday that it marked the ultimate play to take ownership of their own sports destinies, foregoing their reliance on the current distribution service. The launch of this new streaming sports service is a significant moment for Disney and ESPN, a major win for sports fans, and an important step forward for the media business, Disney CEO Bob Iger said in a statement. Disney has been mulling plans to create a standalone ESPN streaming service. The current ESPN Plus lacks rights to major sports, and the new agreement does not appear to prevent it from doing so in the future. We're pumped to bring the Fox Sports portfolio to this new and exciting platform, Fox CEO Lachlan Murdoch said in a statement. We believe the service will provide passionate fans outside of the traditional bundle an array of amazing sports content all in one place. YouTube already offers NFL Sunday Ticket Package, which streams out-of-market games to YouTube Live TV subscribers for about $200 extra per season, depending on discounts. But subscribers can't watch their local teams. What sports are included in the new sports streaming service? In addition to the Big Four, the NFL, the NBA, and the MLB, and NHL, the service will feature NCAA basketball, NASCAR auto racing, the UFC, PGA Golf Tour golf, Grand Slam tennis, the FIFA World Cup, Big Ten football, and other college sports. Which channels will be featured in the sports streaming service? Subscribers will have access to all the broadcast and cable channels owned by each of the companies that feature sports. For Disney, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPNU, SECN, ACCN, ESPN News, and ABC. For Fox Corporation, Fox, FS1, FS2, and the Big Ten Network, and for Warner Brothers, Discovery, TNT, TBS, and True TV. Disney's ESPN Plus, a standalone streaming service with 26 million subscribers, also will be part of the new entity. Though it lacks rights to major sports and is often bundled with Disney Plus and Hulu. Not included, Paramount Global's CBS Sports, which carries most NFL AFC conference games, and Comcast, whose NBC network airs Sunday Night Football and owns the number two cable system. Both already stream their NFL games on Paramount Plus and Peacock, respectively, while the new joint venture partners do not. How much will the streaming service cost? The companies have not announced any pricing plans, but said the new service will be offered in bundles with existing streaming services they own, including Max, Disney Plus, and Hulu. Fox has no current subscription-based service. Will the new service have commercials? Of course. Ad revenue, along with subscription income, is a key to securing profits as sports rights escalate. Other streamers that carry sports, such as Amazon Prime, Thursday Night Football, and Apple TV Plus, Friday Night MLB games and Major League Soccer, have included commercials even when the rest of their programming hasn't. Will cable TV systems suffer? Most definitely. At the ability to stream major sports all in one place knocks down one of the last major pillars of cable, removing one of the last reasons to pay steep monthly fees to buy a package of channels many subscribers don't watch. But the growing number of streaming services can approach the cost of cable when purchased separately. You'll still need cable or a broadcast antenna to watch news coverage, local stations, syndicated programming, and some entertainment programming like award shows that aren't streamed live. Bud Light gets back to basics after controversy. The King of Beers is sparing no expense in its goal to reign supreme over the Super Bowl. And Anheuser-Busch's trio of big brands is calling on saviors old and new to take on a particularly big lift this year. 3 years after sitting out the Super Bowl for the first time in 37 years, Budweiser once again trots out its iconic Clydesdales, this time getting an assist from a Labrador Retriever. Michelob Ultra targets both its middle-aged demographic and the growing soccer section by taking Lionel Messi, Ted Lasso, and Dan Marino's talents to something resembling South Beach. And if Taylor Swift is America's sweetheart, Peyton Manning is its non-threatening dollop of mayonnaise. Who better than Manning, then, to lead the charge for Bud Light in a feverish 60-second spot flanked by Post Malone, UFC's Dana White, and a genie. The theme seems clear. Anheuser-Busch, whose products have claimed 14 championships in USA Today's ad meter measuring public opinion of Super Bowl spots, is getting back to basics. "It's an important moment," said Chief Commercial Officer Kyle Norrington. "It continues to get tougher as a marketer, but this is an amazing moment. People are seeing 10,000 pieces of communications every day, but Super Bowl's just different. The world is watching. This is an opportunity for us to lean in and get back to what we've been doing since 1975, which is great beer marketing. And in a sense, control what they can control. Always listen to our consumers." For decades, heck, Bud bottled its first beer in 1876. Anheuser-Busch has been the oxygen of the USA Today's beer scene, and its modern dominance has come almost in lockstep with the NFL's rise as America's dominant entertainment vehicle. Bud Light's 1982 debut arrived just in time for the Super Bowl to take off as the country's secular holiday, and by the end of the decade, the Bud Bowl added another commercial entry point to join Legacy Bud and its Clydesdales in dominating the big game. By 2001, Bud Light was a top-selling beer in the USA, yet it would relinquish that distinction in 2023. the brand somewhat unwittingly wandered into the battlefield of culture wars after transgender influencer Dylan Mulvaney promoted on Instagram a partnership with Bud Light. Never mind that the number of commemorative Mulvaney cans scarcely represented a drop in Bud Light's ocean of macro brew. It exceeded $5 billion in 2022 sales, nor was it indicative of a significant shift in marketing strategy. The right-wing flotilla attacked with cannons both proverbial and literal blazing. Yet, unlike other instances of aggrieved reactionary backlash, the effect went far beyond Kid Rock's courageous attack on a 12-pack. By July, Bud Light had ceded its number one spot domestically to Modelo, although analysts suggest that the trend line was developing before 2023. The brand then faced more backlash when Mulvaney said the company did not adequately support her in the aftermath. By November, Anheuser-Busch announced Chief Marketing Officer Binay Garbay would be resigning at year's end, with Carrington fully dedicated to marketing going forward. We always listen to our consumers, and what they have been telling us is, give us what we all love about your brands, said Carrington in the path ahead after 2023. So, give us more football. We have reconnected with a partner that we started with many years ago with the UFC. Give us more great fight nights. We're listening, we're learning, and we're continuing to move forward, which is how we're thinking about it. In that way, the Super Bowl, some 10 months after the controversy began, is time fortuitously, said Charles R. Taylor, professor of marketing at Villanova School of Business. It's a crucial moment because enough time has passed that the controversy has died down, said Taylor. I think people are now open to their message in a way that wouldn't have been the case of much last year. Regardless of one's political views, Bud Light really got a bad deal out of it. But when they lost market share leadership after all those years, I absolutely think it's a crucial year to start recovering and turn the consumer's attention to something else and put that in the past. Soccer, anyone? It's no accident Messi and Ted Lasso's Jason Sudeikis is sprinkled into the Michelob Ultra spot. Soccer is about to further dominate the landscape, and Anheuser-Busch is plotting its attack. Michelob Ultra is the official beer of Copa America 24 to be contested in the USA in June and July. One year later, the FIFA Club World Cup will be contested over a similar footprint, and it's all an appetizer for the 2026 World Cup, the final scheduled for New Jersey's MetLife Stadium. I call these the golden years of soccer in America, says Norrington. Really crucial for us to land our connection. We're going to ensure that we make the absolute most of these next few years with soccer and Michelob Ultra. But first, the more familiar football. Las Vegas was deluged with Bud branding even before the 49ers and Chiefs touchdown on the strip. Budweiser has purchased a significant chunk of display time on the still new sphere. A U2 gives way to the Clydesdales in a snow globe type display that will be visible throughout most of town. Lil Wayne and T-Pain will extol the virtues of Michelob Ultra and drop a few tracks Saturday night at the world's largest Topgolf venue. And newly signed Bud Light pitchman Zach Bryan will play to a sold-out crowd Friday at the Cosmopolitan. Come Sunday, Anheuser-Busch reclaims its status as the number one alcohol sponsor for the big game. Whether Bud Light can get back to the top spot is a question for another day. We put some emotional and entertaining content together for America, said Norrington. Our investment as the number one spender on alcohol in the Super Bowl is unwavering, to connect with consumers and brand lovers when everybody's watching. It's a very important piece of the puzzle. And as we look at the calendar year, kicking it off in a big way with the Super Bowl is a way to get things started. Conviction of Shooter's Mom Sends a Message. Tony Montalito still feels sadness surrounding the mass school shooting that took his daughter's life in Parkland, Florida in 2018. But on Tuesday, he also felt some sense of justice. The jury decision in Michigan that found Jennifer Crumbly, the mother of a school shooter, responsible, at least in part, for the 2021 killings at Oxford High School, sends an important signal, Montalito told USA Today. It offers parents of shooting victims some hope that people will take steps to keep guns away from their children. Holding people accountable for their roles in not actively trying to get troubled individuals help before they commit acts of violence will send a strong message, Montalito said. It shows how we all need to come together as parents, students, and teachers. It's the start of the process. There is not one solution to this problem. The jury's decision is the first time the parent of a school shooter has been found guilty of involuntary manslaughter for their part in a mass killing. The Oxford shooting left 4 dead and 7 others injured. This case could alter the future of gun violence in America and how parents are held liable for what their kids do with firearms kept in their homes. Legal experts, gun control advocacy groups, and families affected by gun violence told USA Today. In all, 17 were killed and 17 were injured at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland on February 14, 2018. On Tuesday, Parkland parents were happy to see some accountability from a jury. Because, sadly, in Parkland, we couldn't find a jury who found the shooter or school resource officer fully accountable for the murder, Montecito said. The killer in the Parkland case, Nicholas Cruz, 19 at the time of the murders, was sentenced to life in prison without parole, but the jury deadlocked on imposing the death penalty. What happened in Michigan? On November 30, 2021, Ethan Crumbly shot and killed 4 of his classmates and injured 7 others, including a teacher, with a gun that his parents had bought for him. The Michigan jury in Jennifer Crumbly's trial found her responsible for the murders of the 4 students. During the trial, Crumbly portrayed herself as a doting mother who wasn't aware of her son's mental health struggles and said the responsibility to secure the gun belonged to her husband, James. He is scheduled to go on trial March 5th. But the jury sided with prosecutors who said Crumbly and her husband knew their son was struggling with his mental health, including on the morning of the shooting, but didn't get him help. Prosecutors also said the parents tried to flee from law enforcement. Today's verdict underscores the important responsibility of parents and gun owners in preventing children from having unsupervised access to deadly weapons, said Nick Cipollina, Senior Vice President for Law and Policy at Everytown for Gun Safety. Plain and simple, the deadly shooting at Oxford High School in 2021 should have and could have been prevented had the Crumblys not acquired a gun for their 15-year-old son. Chris Brown, president of gun control advocacy group Brady United, said the ruling has brought some justice to the victims' families. Today's decision sends a powerful message to parents and other parties that they can be responsible for their actions that foreseeably contribute to gun violence, even if they don't pull the trigger, Brown said. Craig Schilling's son, Justin, 17, was killed by Crumbly's son in a high school bathroom. Schilling appeared stoic when the verdict was announced. He bowed his head with clasped hands as he listened to the word guilty, echoing 4 times in the otherwise silent courtroom. I'm happy with the verdict, even though it's still a sad situation to be in, Schilling told reporters after the verdict. I feel that this verdict is going to echo throughout every household in the country. What does the decision mean for the future of gun violence? According to a 2019 U.S. Secret Service report, 76% of school attackers get firearms from the home of a parent or other close relative. In half of the firearms cases, a weapon was either readily accessible or not securely stored, the report says. Some experts say Tuesday's verdict could have a ripple effect on future school gun violence cases. On one hand, we might say that uniquely bad facts make for a unique case, said University of Michigan law professor Iqbal Yanka. On the other hand, the life of the law is precedent. And now that this precedent is out there, prosecutors are going to know that they have another tool in their kit. Everytown for Gun Safety Suplin called the jury's decision an important step forward in ensuring accountability and hopefully preventing future tragedies. David Reidman, founder of the K through 12 school shooting database, said he hopes that seeing a parent headed to prison will make other parents think twice before they leave a gun accessible in their home. Every school shooting committed by a teen who is too young to purchase a firearm would be prevented if the legal owner kept the weapon secure, Reidman said. This verdict was crucial to place responsibility on the adult who purchased a weapon. School shootings committed by students can't happen when kids can't access a gun. On the other hand, Dan Feldman, a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, says he agrees with the Michigan jury's decision, but he's not confident it sets a legal precedent because the outcome of the case doesn't seem out of line with other involuntary manslaughter cases. Jennifer Crumley's lawyer, Shannon Smith, said the case could set a dangerous precedent for parents who are trying to do the best for their children. "This is not justice. This is not how justice works," Smith said. "This does nothing for people who have lost everything, and it does nothing to undo the tragedy that unfolded on November 30th. Parents, states apart, mourn the loss of students killed by shooters. Valentine's Day marks the 6th anniversary of the death of Montalito's daughter Gina and her schoolmates at Parkland. We wish the jury held accountable those responsible to the fullest extent of the law," Montalito said. "Just like the families of Oxford who miss their kids, every day I miss my daughter Gina, and the families in Parkland miss their kids." Israel dismisses Hamas ceasefire offer as delusional. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken offered contrasting reactions Wednesday to Hamas's counter after the latest proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza, reflecting their divergent approaches. In a televised news conference after the two met, Netanyahu emphasized Israel's battleground successes and said, "We are on a way to an absolute victory over Hamas in a matter of months." Netanyahu also said of the militant group's proposal, "Surrendering to Hamas's delusional demands that we heard now not only won't lead to freeing the captives, it will just invite another massacre." In a separate news briefing, as Blinken concluded his fifth Middle East visit since October, the State Department secretary said a deal could still be worked out. "While there are some clear non-starters in Hamas's response, we do think it creates space for agreement to be reached, and we will work at that relentlessly until we get there," he said. Hamas proposed a 135-day ceasefire plan that would include the release of the remaining hostages, withdrawal of Israeli troops from the Gaza Strip, and an end to a war that has killed tens of thousands and left the enclave in ruin. Hamas' proposal has three phases. The proposal, published in Lebanon's El Akbar newspaper, would not require a permanent ceasefire at the outset of the deal, but it would require before the last batch of hostages would be released. First 45-day phase would require a pause in fighting, with Israel repositioning its military forces away from high population areas in Gaza, in addition to the release of female hostages, males under 19, the elderly and sick held by militants. Israel would release 1,500 Palestinians, among them women, children, and 500 selected by Hamas, who may be serving life sentences for terror-related activities. The flow of humanitarian aid would be drastically increased to the enclave, and reconstruction of hospitals, homes, and other crucial buildings also would begin during the first phase. Gazans who were ordered out of their homes by Israeli forces ahead of military assaults would be allowed to return. Talks aimed at a permanent end to the war also would begin. The second phase would require a completion of talks, resulting in an end to the war and the release of the rest of the militant held hostages in exchange for a certain number of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Israel would remove all its troops from Gaza, and reconstruction of the enclave would be stepped up. In the third stage, the two sides would exchange the bodies of those killed in the war, and humanitarian aid into Gaza and reconstruction would continue. The Hamas plan came in response to the latest rounds of talks brokered by the United States, Qatar, and Egypt. The militant group issued a statement thanking Egypt, Qatar, and all the countries that seek to stop the brutal aggression against Palestinians. The war reached its four-month mark on Wednesday. Hamas-led militants crashed across the Israeli border October 7th on a killing spree that left 1,200 people dead. Hours later, the militants fled back to Gaza with more than 240 hostages, over 100 of whom were released during a week-long ceasefire in November. Hamas is still holding more than 130 hostages, but about 30 are believed to be dead, with the vast majority killed on October 7th. More than 27,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's devastating military effort to free the hostages and remove Hamas from power. Israel on Wednesday announced the death of two more of its soldiers in Gaza, raising the total of slain troops in the ground offensive to 227. UN chief fears humanitarian nightmare as Israel targets Rafah. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Wednesday that he is especially alarmed by reports that Israel military is planning a full-scale invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which has seen its population swell as refugees flee the fighting in northern Gaza. Israeli Defense Minister Gallant said this week that Rafah, months ago a city of 180,000 that now houses more than 1 million Palestinians, is the last remaining Hamas stronghold. The Israeli military is reportedly considering an evacuation order that would send residents to northern Gaza, which has been devastated by Israeli military actions there, ahead of a major assault on Rafah. Such an action would exponentially increase what is already a humanitarian nightmare with untold regional consequences, Guterres said in a speech at the UN General Assembly. High Court set for test with Trump's ballot eligibility. The U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday will consider whether U.S. President Donald Trump's role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol disqualifies him from the presidency. The historic case could have huge consequences for this year's election if the justices decide that Trump, the front runner for the GOP nomination, is barred by the Constitution from returning to the White House. It's the biggest presidential election case since the Supreme Court decided Bush versus Gore in 2000, effectively confirming the election of George W. Bush. It's also a major test for the Supreme Court, which has been rocked by ethics scandals, criticism over its 2022 decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, and low public approval ratings. And it's not the only case about Trump the justices will be deciding. Trump is expected to appeal a lower court's ruling that he is not immune to criminal charges he tried to overturn the 2020 election. Here's what you need to know. What is the court deciding? The Supreme Court is deciding whether Colorado's highest court was wrong to exclude Trump from Colorado's primary ballot. The state court said Trump is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, an anti-insurrection provision added after the Civil War to keep government officials who sided with the Confederacy from returning to power. It's the first time the nation's highest court will hear a case on Section 3. What is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? The provision bars people who took an oath to support the Constitution from holding office again if they engaged in insurrection. The clause says, "No person shall be a senator or a representative in Congress, or elector of president or vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress, or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability." Who is challenging Trump's eligibility? 4 Republicans and 2 independent voters in Colorado sued to keep Trump off the state's primary ballot. The voters include the lead plaintiff, Norma Anderson, a registered Republican. Anderson, 91, was the first female majority leader in both the Colorado House and Senate. "Our state law allows us to take certain individuals, if they don't qualify, off the ballot," Anderson said in a video created by Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, C-R-E-W. The watchdog group representing the voters. How did Trump versus Anderson get to the Supreme Court? After a 5-day trial last fall, a Colorado district judge ruled that Trump had engaged in an insurrection by inciting the mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol. But the judge also concluded that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does not apply to a president. After the voters appealed, Colorado's top court in a 4-3 decision said the provision does apply to the presidency and disqualifies Trump from holding the office again. Where else has Trump been challenged? Of the dozens of challenges to Trump filed around the country, the Colorado case is the only one that has succeeded in court so far. Maine Secretary of State, a Democrat, ruled in December that Trump is ineligible for that state's ballot. That decision, which Trump is appealing, is on hold until the Supreme Court rules in the Colorado case. Has anyone else been barred from office because of Section 3? A New Mexico judge last year disqualified County Commissioner and Cowboys for Trump co-founder Coy Griffin from holding public office for engaging in insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Griffin has appealed that decision to the Supreme Court. What are Trump's arguments? Trump's main argument is Section 3 doesn't apply to presidents, and even if it did, he did not engage in insurrection. There was no insurrection, his lawyers wrote in a filing. President Trump did not incite anything, and President Trump did not engage in anything that constitute insurrection. What are the Colorado voters' arguments? Lawyers for the other side say it defies common sense to think the amendment authors wanted to protect the Constitution from every oath-breaking insurrectionist except the person who holds the highest office in the land. By intentionally inciting a violent attack on the Capitol to cling to power, they wrote, Trump engaged in insurrection against the Constitution. How can I listen to the arguments? The court is scheduled to debate Trump versus Anderson at 10 a.m. today. The allotted time is 80 minutes, but is expected to run much longer. Audio is available through the court's website, www.supremecourt.gov. It's also being broadcast on NPR. Will Trump be there? Trump is not scheduled to attend. The oral arguments are the same day as the Nevada caucuses, and Trump is expected to be in the state that night. Who will be arguing for Trump? Trump's lead attorney is Jonathan Mitchell, a former Solicitor General of Texas, who helped create the state's six-week abortion ban that put enforcement in the hands of private citizens. He clerked for former Justice Antonin Scalia and has argued five cases before the Supreme Court. Who will be arguing for the Colorado voters? Jason Murray, a Colorado trial lawyer, will be making his first Supreme Court argument when he represents the Colorado voters today. Murray clerked for Justice Elena Kagan on the Supreme Court and for Justice Neil Gorsuch when he was on the Denver-based 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Will anyone else be arguing? Colorado's Solicitor General Shannon Stevenson was granted 10 minutes to represent Colorado Secretary of State Gina Griswold. The case began when Griswold was sued by the six voters seeking a court order to keep her from certifying Trump's place on the ballot. Griswold asked for time before the justices because, she said, Trump's appeal affects her ability to interpret and enforce Colorado's election laws. What is the Biden administration's view? The Department of Justice has not weighed in on this case, and unlike in other high-profile cases involving federal issues, the Supreme Court did not ask for the executive branch's views. When will the Supreme Court make a decision? The court has no deadline. The justices have been urged to settle the issue before more voters go to the polls. Haley has symbolic hit in loss of to none in November primary. Reno, Nevada. In an embarrassing setback, former Carolina Governor Nikki Haley lost the Nevada GOP presidential primary Tuesday to none of these candidates. The loss is largely meaningless because former President Donald Trump decided to skip the Nevada presidential preference primary and instead is expected to win the GOP-run caucuses Thursday night. That victory will give him all 26 of the state's delegates. But it's a symbolic hit to the former governor, who came in third in Iowa and second in New Hampshire, and heads next to her home state's February 24th Republican primary. She captured almost 32% of the vote, while none claimed nearly 62% of close to two-thirds of the state's votes counted. A number of Republican voters, initially confused about why Trump wasn't on their ballot, said they voted for none of these candidates in support of the former president. "I wanted Donald Trump to be on there," said Republican voter Ron Stanley, 64, truck driver, who dropped off a ballot in person in downtown Reno shortly before noon. At first, when he saw Trump's name wasn't on his ballot, he thought maybe elections managers were pulling a fast one. But once he understood Trump chose to skip the primary, Stanley said he assumed the former president had his reasons. "He voted for none in protest," said Stanley, who used to work in the Texas oil fields. "Nikki Haley is not the answer. Trump's a guy who has shown from his business background that he can make the hard decisions we need. Small business and family farms are just getting pounded by so many restrictions. The answer is not more government." Nevada's competing caucus and primary were the first nominating contest in the West. Tuesday's election is unusually quiet compared to past years, with no campaign signs visible and no enthusiastic voters cheering for their preferred candidate outside polling sites. Turnout appeared to be low, with no evident lines and fewer than 12,000 ballots cast by 2 p.m. About 150,000 Nevadans voted early or by mail-in or absentee ballot, roughly 13% of eligible voters, according to the state of Secretary of State's office. Although none of the candidates received more votes, according to Nevada state law, the person who gets the most votes is declared the winner. Outside a Reno polling place on Tuesday, Gary Beninetti, 75, said he hoped Haley would stay in the race. A longtime Republican voter, Beninetti said he can't stomach the idea of another Trump presidency. We need a change. I'm tired of the drama, he said. If it doesn't work out with her, I'll change to independent. I'm just not going to vote for Trump. Too many red flags hanging over his head. Beninetti rejected the idea of participating in Thursday's GOP caucuses. If you want to argue with someone, there are better places to do it, he said. We should do away with caucuses. We need to get back to civility in the Republican Party. The Haley campaign noted it did not campaign in Nevada because the whole thing had been a setup for Trump. Even Donald Trump knows that when you play penny slots, the House wins, said spokesperson Olivia Perez Cubas. We didn't bother to play a game rigged for Trump. We're full steam ahead in South Carolina and beyond. Trump wasn't on the ballot, but many wish he had been. Many Republican voters on Tuesday remained confused why Trump's name was missing from the primary ballot, despite an extensive public education campaign by media and election managers. Washoe County Register of Voters Carrie Ann Burgess said most voters were understanding once her staff explained Trump himself decided to skip the primary. He opted out of participating in the Nevada presidential preference primary, Burgess said Tuesday, but he's in the caucus. Republican Michael Halton, who works in manufacturing, said he begrudgingly voted for none of these candidates at a South Reno polling site. Holton, 61, said he wished Trump could have participated in the primary so that the former president could defeat Haley in a head-to-head competition. Holton said Haley, a former Trump ambassador to the United Nations, is disloyal running against her former boss. I'm bummed he's not on the ballot, Holton said. I feel the caucus will be strong for him, but I'm just bummed he's not on the ballot. Former Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval, a Republican, laughed and declined to say who he voted for after casting his ballot. He's now president of the University of Nevada, Reno, voted at the University Student Union. Sandoval told USA Today he thinks most of the concern over the dueling primary and caucus has passed and said he favored anything that gets more people to participate in the political process. Yes, there will be a little bit of confusion, but if it encourages more people to get out there and be part of the process, I'm all for it, he said. President Joe Biden, who faced no serious opposition on the ballot, clearly cleared nearly 90% of the Democratic vote. He easily bested self-help author Marianne Williamson and a number of other challengers who met basic qualification rules. Nearly 6% of Democrats voted for none of these candidates. In acknowledging his win in a statement shortly before midnight East Coast time, Biden thanked Nevada Democrats for supporting him and praised them as the backbone of our nation. Voter Bruce Bartlett, 80, said he voted for Biden to show support for the president. Bartlett, a retired investigator for the district attorney, said Biden has done a good job improving the United States, given what he inherited from Trump. We're concerned about our country and want to try to do the right thing, Bartlett said. House fails to impeach Mayorkas. The House rejected a GOP push Tuesday to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, a significant blow to the Republicans trying to make immigration and border a top issue heading into the 2024 elections. The vote failed by a count of 214-216 to not impeach Mayorkas, with no Democrats supporting the move and a handful of Republicans joining them. It was always a heavy lift for House Republican leaders to push the impeachment effort through, considering their razor-thin majority in the lower chamber. That means Republicans could hardly afford to lose any votes in the impeachment fight. House Republicans voted on two articles of impeachment, accusing Mayorkas of a willful and systematic refusal to comply with the law and a breach of public trust. Mayorkas, a GOP lawmaker, say, has intentionally allowed the border crisis to continue. But Democrats, a small number of House Republicans, and legal experts across the political spectrum have long dismissed Republicans' impeachment push. They say the GOP's grievances with Mayorkas amount to nothing more than policy disagreements over how to handle the border and America's immigration system. Impeaching him, they say, would set a dangerous precedent for future impeachments. And some Republicans also raise questions about the push to impeach the secretary, Representative Tom McClintock, Republican from California, released a statement Tuesday saying nothing would change, even if Mayorkas were removed from office. The crisis at the border, McClintock said, can only be solved after the 2024 elections to replace the entire administration, and that can only be done by the American people at the ballot box. The White House also has long criticized the impeachment push, issuing a stark warning to Republicans ahead of the vote. Impeaching Secretary Mayorkas would trivialize this solemn constitutional power and invite more partisan abuse of this authority in the future, the White House said in a statement on Monday. If the House of Representatives wishes to address the border, the Constitution provides an obvious means, passing legislation. Even if the House did approve the articles, the prospect of removing Mayorkas from his office faced long odds in the Senate, which has the power to hold a trial to remove an impeached official. Senator Majority Leader Chuck Schumer declined to commit to even holding these proceedings. Even if there were a trial, Mayorkas would almost certainly be acquitted. Conviction requires a two-thirds vote, and Democrats control the chamber. The push to impeach Mayorkas came at a fraught time for the Senate's bipartisan $118 billion deal that would overhaul migration policy and provide to the Ukraine and Israel. House Republican leaders have all but killed the agreement, expressing doubt even before they had the formal text of the bill. Instead, House GOP leaders have insisted that Congress should pass their bill that significantly restricts migrant claims, referred to as H.R. 2. The bill received no Democratic votes when it passed the House last year, and it hasn't been taken up by the Democratic-controlled Senate. At the same time, House Republicans are also arguing there's no need to pass new legislation addressing the border, instead claiming President Joe Biden already has powers to stymie the flow of migrants to the U.S. Any consideration of this Senate bill in its current form is a waste of time. It is dead on arrival in the House, House Speaker Mike Johnson, House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, and House Majority Whip Tom Emmer, and House GOP Conference Chair Elise Stefanik said in a joint statement. And that is all the time we have for this first hour of USA Today, which is Thursday, February 8th. Stay tuned and become more informed.